Monday. Welcome to the beginning of the week. We kick off with a magnificent show tonight. For those who don't know, I'm Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. Tonight we're having a special In Conversation where two fantastic authors get to sit and talk to each other about books and writing and process and all those other wonderful things. My guest host tonight is Carter Wilson, who last night just won the Colorado Book Award for the second year in a row. Congratulations, Carter Wilson. I'm thrilled that you are with me tonight, and congratulations on winning the award for Revelation. We're going to talk to Carter and Randall Silvis, his guest, in just a moment. So please don't go away. Everyone to Authors on the Air. My very special guest host tonight is Carter Wilson, whose fifth book, Revelation, won last night the Colorado Book Award again. This is the second year in a row he's won. For those who've been living under a rock and don't read books, and it's really a shame, Carter writes psychological suspense, and I'm telling you, the paranoia in his dark domestic thrillers will just about creep anybody out. They are so good that he's won an International Book Award, the National Indie Excellence Award, and the Colorado Book Award for prior works. His fifth novel, Mr. Tender's Girl, will be released this February in 2018 by Source Books. It's my pleasure to welcome to the show your host tonight, Carter Wilson. Carter, welcome back to Authors on the Air. It's your microphone.
Hey, thank you very much, Pam, and I appreciate the opportunity to get to interview somebody who I'm very impressed by as well. So I appreciate that very much. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce Randall now. And Randall, I'm going to make you sit there and endure me kind of gawking over your bio here. And normally when I see these bios, you know, I'll tend to, if I'm introducing somebody, I'll truncate them a little bit. But this is such an impressive bio that if you'll bear with me, I want to read this in full. Randall Silvis is the internationally acclaimed author of over a dozen novels, one story collection, and one book of narrative nonfiction. Also a prize-winning playwright, a produced screenwriter, and a prolific essayist, he's been published and produced in virtually every field and genre of creative writing. His numerous essays, articles, poems, and short stories have appeared in the Discovery Channel magazines, The Writer, Prism International, Short Story International, Manoa, and other numerous online and print magazines, and his work has been translated into 10 languages. So, Randall, welcome. That's very impressive. Thanks for being
Carter.
On tonight.
Thank you for having me. Congratulations on the Colorado Book Award yet again.
Well, I appreciate that very much. So it's interesting as I was, I know your work, and then as I was going through your bio and just reading that, it kind of makes me wonder, do you just ever just sit, do you give yourself the time to just sit and reflect of like, Jesus, I've done a lot of stuff in my life. That's pretty impressive. Or is that never quite good enough? Are you always striving for more?
Yeah, I mean, initially there's a great deal of satisfaction when something good comes up, but it lasts about 2 days at most. And then it's like, okay, what are you going to do now?
Interesting. Well, you've delved into a lot of different types of writing. Is there, and I'm going to focus tonight mostly on 2 Days Gone, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I am curious about just your path with writing and delving into the different types. Are you drawn to one over the other, or are you just, hey, I've never written a screenplay, I want to try that. What's that like? What's the attraction?
Yeah, that's pretty much the second option you gave. I think the first time I wrote a play, I had been writing a lot of short stories, and I won a residency at the McDowell Artist Colony in New Hampshire. And I thought, okay, 8 weeks in McDowell, what am I going to do, right? Some more short stories?
Right.
And I decided I'd try something different. So I had never written a play, and I really didn't even know how to write a stage play. But I thought, okay, I've got a book of Thornton Wilder's plays here on my shelf. I'll take that with me, and I'll learn how to format a play, and I'll write a stage play. So I wrote my first stage play at the McDowell Colony. And I got lucky enough to win a regional prize with it and to get a play commission based upon it from Clarion University of Pennsylvania. So I thought, well, I'm going to write plays for a while. So that's what I did.
That's fantastic. How many plays have you done?
I haven't written a play in a long, long time, but I did 12 altogether.
Wow.
And it was after my second one off Broadway that I realized I was spending more money staying in New York City for a few days than I was making for the entire run of the play. So
right.
It was time to find something a little more lucrative.
Well, and that's just it, right? And I'd like to talk about this a little bit more later, but the whole business side of writing, you have to kind of split your brain in half, and you know, you can be as creative and as prolific as you want, but you have to, you know, understand the dollars and cents of it all too, because it's a brutal industry. I mean, from my perspective, it's a pretty brutal industry. I don't know about you, but it's not easy to make a lot of money being a writer, and you're kind of chasing a lot of different types of writing. Are you finding some that you're like, okay, I've realized that if I write this, that makes the most economic sense for me. Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, and I think I know which is the most lucrative, or which certainly has been the most lucrative for me. Back when I was writing screenplays, I could make as much money in 8 weeks as I could make in a full semester of teaching.
Wow.
So that is a lucrative profession when you have the right agent, the right person handling you and getting you jobs, as I did before my agent retired. But also after my first play was produced, after one of my screenplays was produced and I got banned from the set, I decided that I wasn't going to work with actors or directors anymore, and I started putting more and more of my time and my attention into novels.
Why were you banned from the set? I mean, you can't just let that go.
Man. It's a long story, but I'll try to make it very short. The play was in production. There'd been a lot of turmoil before this, but the play was in production, and the screenplay was in production, and my producer in Hollywood every night would send me a fax that said, the cover sheet always said the same thing, can you fix this, please? And then there were the pages that people involved with the shooting, with the film, were tweaking, and he wanted me to fix them so that they didn't know I'd fixed them, so that they didn't know that that their revisions were being deleted, basically. And when I and then he treated me and my family to a week on location. And the first day I showed up with the associate producer, the director did not know who I was. But as it happened, the associate director saw my two little tow-headed boys and wanted them to be extras, so we were. And then whenever he came over to thank me, the associate producer told him who I was. His jaw dropped. He walked across the street, whispered into the director's ear, and she stood up and screamed, "This set is closed." And that was for me, because I had, previous to going down, I had wanted to back out and get my name off the script because of the changes that were being made. And
wow.
And the producer made them stop changing, making revisions, and she, that's why I was banned from the set. She didn't want me there. So it's a
wow.
Lot, the full story is a lot more convoluted.
right.
And
a lot more sensitive.
Yeah, a lot more carnage than I told you about. But that's the short version.
Wow. Well, so novels it is then. You don't want to deal with the Hollywood egos. So. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, your ability to write suspense, because 2 Days Gone is what just came out earlier this year from Sourcebooks Landmark. And, you know, maybe as a quick prelude to the listeners there, if they're not familiar with the work, if you want to just give a quick overview of the story, that would be fantastic.
Oh, 2 Days Gone. It's basically about two men. One is Thomas Houston, who's a college professor in a small college town. He has recently, with his fourth book, he's suddenly experienced success. It's a bestseller. Has a beautiful wife and three beautiful children. By all appearances, he has the perfect life. Everything's going fine with him. And the other character is Sergeant Ryan DeMarco of the Pennsylvania State Police, who has some ghosts in his past and some things that he's trying to overcome in his life as well. They become friends when Houston is doing a little research for his next novel, and he spends several days and lunches and barbecues with DeMarco, and they get to know each other, mainly because they're both still reeling from past tragedies in their life, and they feel a sense of kinship. But then one night, Thomas Houston's entire family is slaughtered, and he is seen walking away from the home at dawn the next morning, and he basically disappears. So it falls upon DeMarco to track him down and bring him to justice if he, in fact, is responsible for their family's death.
Excellent. Yeah, and it's gotten phenomenal reviews. And just, you know, to pull a few quotes, you know, Booklist calls it an impressive novel, an intriguing thriller. Publishers Weekly, who is not quick to praise, calls it a skillfully written thriller. And Library Journal gave it a starred review, a suspenseful literary thriller that will resonate with readers long after the book is finished. And it's funny, if you look at some of the I was just calling even through some of the Goodreads reviews, because it's always interesting to see what fans are saying about books. And what, you know, after reading several, what I lifted from it is how I see this book. And the comments that resonated with me, which I agree with, are dark and brooding, tortured characters, beautiful writing. And I couldn't agree with those more. It's a fantastic book. And really, above all, it's dark. It's a dark work of fiction. That's something that I personally gravitate to, and I think it's a very hard thing to pull off a book that is dark but still appealing. And you start out, with it in your face to the reader, and you kind of, the way that I see this book is you kind of pose the question. And I don't know, I'd like to know how the idea for the book came to you, but you kind of posed the question, essentially, why would anyone who has everything just suddenly throw it away? Just the whole why. If he did this crime, why would he do this? He's, your protagonist has everything, seemingly has everything going for him. What was kind of the inception point for you with this story? Was it a question like that, or did you actually have a whole narrative already in mind?
No, and I seldom start with a whole narrative. This one started with a scene. I was teaching at the time, and I think I was teaching some morning classes. My commute was about an hour long, and I drove up Interstate 79 north towards Erie, and every morning around 7 or 7:30, I would cross over Lake Wilhelm. And depending on the day, it could either be full of sunlight with the sun coming up over the lake, or it could be filled with fog and misty and shrouded with darkness. But every morning I would see it, and it would always strike me as beautiful, no matter what the ambiance was. And then one day I happened to look at it and see all the darkness of the woods and so forth, and I thought, this would be a great place to set a murder. This would be a great place to hide a body. And I started with that scene, and then as the days went by and I continued to drive back and forth, my main character, Sergeant Ryan DeMarco, I just envisioned I just envisioned a state policeman, a sergeant in charge of other troopers, and I saw him standing there by the side of the road with all the other troopers and maybe a couple of canines, and getting ready to enter in the woods to search for somebody, and to search for the murderer, basically. And that's what I started with, just those two particular visual scenes. And from there, as I'm sure you know, writers tend to carry the book around in their head for a while. Some people write things down. I don't do an outline. I'll jot notes, bits of dialogue or whatever, until I feel that I know enough about the book to, or at least the first scene to start writing. And then I just hope that the characters grow from there and tell their own story.
So if I'm hearing this right, so you're containing a lot of it in your head before you even do any writing. So it's not like you're writing as you go along and fleshing it out. You're just kind of letting it kind of develop in your mind for a while before you do anything.
Yes, I especially have to know the first couple sentences, and I just roll them over in my head, and until they're polished and they sound right for the. But I trust that the voice will find itself, the voice for the particular story. So once I have those first few sentences and I know what the rest of the scene is going to be, and I have one or two road signs along the way, I know where it's going to start, I know where it's going to end, and with a little bit of luck, I know some signpost in the middle that I'm going to work towards. And that's really all I go with before I start writing.
Do you ever... I'm always interested in, you know, the whole idea of, like, I know the ending versus I don't know the ending. Because I'm a little bit the opposite. I don't know what the hell I'm doing half the time. Well, I'm three quarters of the time. And I'm just writing, and I'm hoping, you know, against everything that it's all going to ultimately make sense and that my subconscious will kick in with something really good. But so knowing the ending, do you ever get to that point and be like, this isn't really the ending I want. I want it to be different.
Yeah, the ending that I initially conceive is almost never the ending that appears in the book, because the characters grow and they do things that I didn't expect them to be, and new characters pop up that I didn't expect or didn't envision in the beginning. So, yeah, I'm like you. I really trust my subconscious to create the story and to keep telling it and making it richer and more layered and so forth. So if after, what, 6, 7, 8 months of writing, the ending of the book ends up being exactly as I envisioned it, I'd be disappointed because I feel that the book didn't grow organically. So, yeah, I hope that it's going to be different.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting. And yeah, I want to get back to just kind of the darkness of the writing a little bit. How important was that to you? Because is it Huston? Is that his last name?
I pronounce it Houston.
Houston, okay. Thomas Houston's family is, as you mentioned, slaughtered, and it's brutal. Now, how important was it to you, the method in which they were killed in terms of the story? Was it important that it was as brutal as it was?
Well, I knew that it had to be done quietly, so that was the determining factor, basically. But I chose to open it with that because for a long time I thought, what is the most horrific thing you can imagine happening to a man? And I'm a father. I have two beautiful sons who are now full-grown men, and I, you know, I adore them. They were the center of my life when they were growing up, and they still are pretty much the center of my life. I talk to them both a couple times a week, even if it's only by text. So to me, the worst thing that could happen to a man would be to lose his family. And so I decided, you know, that's what I'm going to do to Thomas Houston. He's going to lose his family, and it needed to be done quietly. So I chose to, and there's something a little more, as you say, dark. There's a little more brutal having it done by knife, by hand, rather than even from a distance of 3 or 4 feet with a gun. So that was my rationale.
Yeah, it's much more it's much more personal.
Yes, it's a more
crime committed like that. It's it's completely a different motivation, and the reader has so much of a different impact on the reader, because I was reading it and I always struggle with, because I've written some pretty brutal stuff as well, and I always struggle with, well, what is it that I like to read versus what is it that I like to write? And sometimes I read scenes of brutality that, you know, really hit me, like, wow, that's, I didn't think I'd be this affected by that. Was that difficult for you to kind of get into that space? Or, I mean, have you just written so much in your life that you can just jump into that mental place very quickly and get back out?
No, I and it's funny because I know you and everybody else who reads it apparently sees it as very dark. And it's strange because I never think of the darkness in the novel. I think of trying to take my character into the light. And so for me, I'm never focusing on the dark elements. I know they're there, but I'm never focusing on them. What I'm trying to do is to express them, actually with some understatement. I don't want to be too terribly explicit. And so sometimes when I've had readers tell me, when I've gone to conferences and so forth, they tell me that they had to stop after the first chapter, and it took them days to get over it before they could go back and start reading again. And that made me feel bad. It made me feel bad because I didn't want to do that to anybody. But I understand.
Well, everyone's got different sensitivities, right? You can't account for all readers, for sure. We all know that.
Yeah,
I mean,
so
I've definitely been in that situation as well.
Do you find, are you often surprised by the responses that you get from your readers?
Yeah, I can be. I mean, I've been considered in some groups like more of a horror writer, which I definitely wouldn't consider myself that at all. Maybe some of my earlier stuff, but I mean, I'm sure you know the same thing. You'll get the whole gamut from, like, you know, I couldn't, this literally, I lost sleep over this because it was so disturbing. And then the next reel will say, yeah, it didn't really move fast enough for me. It was kind of boring.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you don't know what to do.
Right.
But,
yeah, you're reaching up as people that have the same sensibilities as you do.
Yeah, I feel like you can only be, you know, if you chase the readers, it's going to make your life really difficult because you'll never satisfy everybody. And then I think you end up with a fairly compromised product if you end up doing that. So all you can do is kind of stay true to yourself. And I think you do that. I feel like your voices are very strong in this, and I feel like they're not pandering to any kind of reader at all. And one thing you did phenomenally in this, which is a terribly difficult thing to do, and I don't know if you struggled with this, but so you're writing from two different points of view. You're writing, probably primarily from DeMarco, who's investigating the crime and trying to figure out where Houston is. But then you're alternating back to Houston himself, and you're in his POV, and you're not – he knows everything, but you're not revealing it even though you're inside his head. Was that a really difficult thing to balance there, like not giving away anything?
It was difficult to give information that kept attention high or kept the reader interested in him, but not to give away too much too early. Yeah, basically, yes. Yeah, it was tricky. That was probably in terms of slowing down and thinking about what I could say before I said it. That was probably the section of the book that had me writing most deliberately and at the most measured pace. Generally, I tend to write quickly, but with that, those sections, I did have to slow down.
Got it. Well, we're going to pause real quickly for a station break and station identification. We're talking here with Randall Silvas, the author of Two Days Gone.
And you are listening to Authors on the Air. This is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. If you'd like to join this magnificent conversation between Carter Wilson and Randall Solvis, please call 347-633-9609. Again, that's 347-633-9609. All yours, Carter.
Thank you, Pam. So, Randall, you mentioned you normally write fairly quickly. What do you mean by that? How long does it typically take you to write something like a novel of this length versus maybe something that might have taken a little bit longer with this novel in particular?
Well, this novel in particular, I started in 2006.
Somebody asked me
a while back, when I wrote it, and I had to dig up all my old folders and look back to my hard drive, and I actually started it in 2006. I think I probably wrote I was teaching then as well. So when I'm teaching, generally I have a 3-day schedule, teaching schedule, which means I can write most every Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday morning, and I'll generally write for about 4 hours at a time before I stop. On the teaching days, I get up very early so that I can get an hour or two of note-taking, not too much real composition, but thinking things through and taking notes for myself for the next day's work. A book this size, I would like to have at least a full year to work on it, and that would give me at least 2 drafts to go through. Let's call it 3 drafts, because since I read each previous day's work before I start in the morning, then by the time I get to the end, I've already done 2 drafts, and then I like to do another full draft before I show it to anybody, before I send it to my agent.
So nobody has seen it within that time and in that process. Nobody has seen it but you, no critique group or, your family or anything like that, or is it just all for your eyes only at that point?
It's just me. I'm not of the MFA generation. I don't have a degree in creative writing. I've never taken a course in creative writing, so I'm not used.
Hey,
to
me neither.
Excellent.
Salut.
I teach creative writing at both the graduate and the undergraduate level, so I've conducted lots of workshops, but I'd never been critiqued in a workshop, so I'm not used to that. And I don't want anybody to see what I write until it's as good as I can make it. And I've never depended on anybody else to tell me what works or what doesn't. I just sort of trusted my own instincts. So you too, no MFA. There aren't many of us out there these days.
Yeah, no, I did. I have a business degree, and I kind of just started writing in my early 30s, like literally on a particular day I just started. What's interesting about you saying that about not showing it to anyone is there's this weird mixture in there, right? Of like almost like this huge confidence that like I'm going to completely write this novel and not get any feedback on it until it's done because I know what I'm doing. And then on the other hand, there's the I don't want anyone to see it until it's perfect. But you know, I suffer from the whole idea like this probably sucks, and I don't know if it's any good until I get some feedback. So I usually give my agent the first 100 pages of anything I write to just, is this generally in the right direction? I can't imagine actually one time I did a whole novel without showing anyone, and I gave it to her, and she basically said this is terrible. So maybe that's where it's coming from. That's a pretty bold thing to do, but you can get, I guess, lost in different critique along the way and lose your voice a little bit if you're, showing it around a lot.
Yeah. I've in conducting workshops, I've seen lots of really good writers, distinctive and original writers, get savaged in the workshop because they're writing at a level that's higher than most of the people in the workshop. And
oh, that's interesting.
And they just get savaged, and I have to be the one to say, all right, I'm going to disagree with everybody here because I think this is brilliant writing. But I've had a few students like that in over the course of the years who just are more harmed by the workshop than they are helped by it.
Do you think it's because part of that talent, right, is part of criticism is knowing how to absorb it, and then to also which voices to listen to. Because after a while, you start to identify, yes, you're completely right, and you know you're not right, and I can tell the difference between those. Is that an important thing for your students to pick up on?
It definitely is, and I give them that a little disclaimer at the beginning of every semester when we're doing workshopping. You know, I tell them, look, listen to what everybody says, but it's up to you. This is your work, and you should not change your work for any one particular person to suit any person, and even me, because they do tend to want to write. I found students trying to imitate my work, and it became obvious. And I would, you know, tell them, stop this right now, because you're not writing, you're not writing to impress me. You're writing to express your own voice and to make it, to get it out into the public, because that's what they all want. They want to be published. So yeah, it's a difficult thing, because they all want approval, and rejection really hurts. Always stings, and public rejection in a workshop setting really stings, and
right.
it's a tough thing for some people to take. I've seen students get up and leave the table because they became too emotional from the criticism. But,
right.
It's a little bit
of preparing them for the real world, though, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I collected rejections on my short stories for 10 years before I ever sold any. Well,
right.
8 years. 8 years, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It took me 80 agents to find one, and it wasn't then until my fifth completed novel that finally sold. So But you learn from that, right? A lot of times you'll get the feedback, and you might disagree with it, but you start to see a trend like, okay, my protagonist is, you know, is too weak most of the time, or,
yeah.
You know, and it opens your eyes a little bit, as opposed to maybe somebody who just writes something and says, well, I'm going to self-publish it because I want it to be out there. And maybe it's not ready to be out there. Maybe it needs to be rejected a few times, and you learn from that.
Yeah. And most of the self-published stuff that I've read, it needs more work, and it isn't ready to be seen. And, you know, when you go through the self-publishing process and then it's just uniformly trashed by people, that's got to be devastating. So
set a reputation for yourself.
Yeah, yeah. It is a brutal business because it's because the rejection rate is so high, and writers have to be prepared for the fact that even good writers have to be prepared for the fact that they are going to be rejected. And rejected again and again until their writing is up to the level that it should be, that it must be if they're going to compete with other professionals.
So, what are most of the students that you're teaching right now? What are they, you know, do they aspire to be, you know, commercially viable writers, or what is kind of the overarching theme of what you're seeing with your classrooms?
They're overwhelmingly unprepared. They haven't read enough to know the history of writing. They haven't read any of the masters. I've handed out sheets of paper with maybe 25 of the masters on them listed, and they haven't read any of them. They might have said, well, I saw the movie, but they haven't read the book, so they don't know the history of American literature. They really have not lived, so most of them are writing strictly from imagination, so they're writing a lot of fantasy, a lot of swords and sorcery and mages and wizards. So I'm of the school that the best teacher is life, is experience. And I say, I've counseled many wannabe MFA students, and including my own son. The MFA is not going to make you a better writer, and it's not going to make you a better person. Take that $20,000 that you would spend and travel the world and listen to people and interact with nature and with the world as a whole and things that you don't even understand. And you'll come back, I think, as a more mature human being and as a more sensitized human being. And therefore, you'll have something to write about. And then you can apply. And I think anybody can learn craft. I think anybody can learn to be learn basically English grammar and to write a good, clear sentence. And they can learn story structure. But you can't learn human nature unless you participate in it and you're a strong observer of it. And you can't become sensitized to the human condition unless you're really out in the world experiencing it, not just moving from home to a classroom to another classroom. So
is that a disillusioning thing to say to your students?
They come expecting that the degree guarantees a publication, and when I tell them the real statistics about the number of individuals who actually get published, with the number of individuals with MFAs who actually get published, some of them are pretty devastated.
Get published and, you know, can actually live above the poverty line.
Exactly.
And those are two different, very, very different achievements, I think. And the percentages go down quite a bit with the second one there. Well, speaking of just writing from experience, I mean, so it's interesting. So, you know, you're a teacher and you're a novelist, just like Thomas Houston in your novel. Was that important for you to kind of have those parallel lines drawn between your life and your protagonists?
It wasn't important to me. It was really a matter of necessity at the time because I was teaching full time, and when I first started that book, it was 2006, and my wife and I had just gotten divorced. My youngest son was still in high school, and my oldest son was in college, about 30 miles from where I lived. So both of my sons were fairly close. So I wanted, even though I had now the freedom to move anywhere I wanted to stay close to my sons. So I was teaching full time. I wanted to stay close to my sons. So I wanted to write another novel, but I couldn't go away anywhere and research it. And even though I was kind of bored with the area because I'd been around here for 10 years, I decided, well, I'm going to have to choose a setting that I already know and I'm very familiar with. And so, as I said, the scene that I passed every day became part of it. And then, because I've been in academia off and on for the past 25 years, I decided it was time to write my revenge novel against academia. So I conceived of having an academic be the murderer. And so that's what I intended to be. And I was going to reveal all of the pettiness and all the narrow-mindedness of academia, and all of the jealousy and the backstabbing and everything that goes on in academia. Of course, you know, the book had different ideas. The characters had different ideas. So it ended up not being the revenge novel I expected it to be, but it ended up being something else.
But there are elements of that for sure.
Yeah,
the reader gets taken inside the institution, and there's a lot of bitterness and there's a lot of jealousy between professors that it was clear that you had at least some observations of from your own past. I'm taking it.
Yeah, as I said, I've never sought tenure because I knew what a swamp it becomes for a writer. I knew lots of writers who had gotten tenure track jobs and never wrote another book, or they wrote some little obscure book, little thin book that they published with the University Press that sold 200 copies or something over because they wrote it over summer break. So I knew what academia will do to a writer's career. So I always chose to have a position that's called full-time temporary, which means a year-to-year contract. And that also gave me the freedom when I wanted to not teach, rather than having to wait 7 years and take a sabbatical if I were tenure track. So that was my choice. But so that always made me an outsider. It made me on the fringe of academia so that I could observe everybody. But it also, because I was an outsider, I was privy. People would come and tell me all of their stories, and they'd complain to me because they knew that I was an outsider. So I knew what was going on all the time. Plus,
That's good. You get the inside scoop.
Yeah, exactly. So I won't say I was never the object of any of the nefarious stuff. I was frequently. Because they also, on the other hand, they don't like outsiders, and they especially don't like outsiders who keep publishing books when they want to publish books. So yeah, I did experience a lot of it, and I observed a lot of it.
Interesting. Well, I also want to ask you about your character, Sergeant Ryan DeMarco, because I think when you see comments about the book having tortured characters, you know, it's easy to think about Thomas Houston, who we've been discussing, and this tragedy that he's going through. But Ryan DeMarco is a completely tortured character. And I love that because I love it when that kind of character doesn't have a simple heroic purpose, that he's conflicted and he's got his own demons that he's wrestling with. And he's had things happen in his past. He's had tragedy in his past, and he's had, he's divorced. And it's funny, he has a really kind of an odd, and I'm not going to give too much away here, but odd routine with his ex-wife, that he kind of has a sense of needing to kind of still protect her. And I remember reading that, and I'm like, this is really interesting. I actually talked to my girlfriend about it. I kind of described to her, you know, what this character was doing, and we just kind of talked about it. Was that, you know, where did that come from? Was that, is that how you envisioned, you know, this is completely plausible, that this is what would happen after this kind of tragedy?
You know, I am not an analytical writer. I have a friend who sits down and analyzes and thinks everything out and plots everything out. I just kind of listen to my characters. And so I'm writing along one day, and I know that they're estranged, but they're not divorced. And, you know, he goes to check on her, and the rest of it just kind of occurs to me. And I just trust
it. Right.
You know, my feeling is I'm going to write it out and see how it works.
Right.
The agent I had at the time when I wrote it, when I first wrote it, he loved all of it, but that storyline, he said, that you just get that out of there. He said, it's just muddying up the water. And I disagreed with him completely. And that, among many other reasons, was why he's no longer my agent. And now I have lots of readers tell me how moved they are by his attachment to her and by his relationship with her. And to me, and I know you understand this, Carter, because I can see it in Alice, in the main character of Mr. Tender's Girl. She has her past. She has tragedies that she is trying to overcome. And that adds the depth to the character. That adds, that creates a kind of inner journey. Besides the, it's how do I say this, an inner conflict. And then it has to interact with the external conflict, the opposing forces that come from outside of her. And to me, that makes a much richer, deeper character when there's an inner journey as well as an outer journey, an outer goal. And if there's no inner journey, I'm not really interested in that character. I want to see character growth and character development, and I want to see the character tested under pressure. So for me, the most important part is the character development, the character growth.
Right, and you layer on such, like, by doing what you did, you layer on such a level of complexity that, you know, it can be off-putting to somebody who wants to read something simple, you know, who doesn't want to be jolted by an expectation that doesn't match, you know, what they had going into the novel.
Right.
And but it's much more fun and challenging, like you said, to say, no, this is what happens, and deal with that, reader, in a way, without being too cocky about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in a small town, and I've always chosen to live in small towns, mainly because of the quiet and the ability to have seclusion, which is vital for my well-being. But also, you know, on the surface, small towns might look idyllic and quaint and so forth, but the undercurrent of just about every small town I've ever known is filled with all kinds of darkness and all kinds of deceptions and strange behavior that is accepted as normal. And so basically, I draw a lot from what I observed, what I knew, what I experienced, and what I heard about when I was growing up in these small towns. And I'm sure what happens in small towns is pretty much what happens in cities. I don't know.
Well, yeah, there's something much more kind of darkly romantic about the small town. And there was an element of reading your book that kind of reminded me of Capote's In Cold Blood. Just the thematic elements of kind of a family being wiped out, and it's this small town, and how that, you know, resonates throughout this community. Did that occur to you at all, that book, while you were writing it? Did that was there a connection there at all?
You mean with Cold Blood, In Cold Blood?
Yeah.
Well, no, but I'm flattered that you would even say my book in the same breath with Capote's. That's a masterful piece of work.
It is.
I just try to write a story with complex characters and characters who grow and learn a little something about themselves by the end of the novel. That's my, you know, Flannery O'Connor called it the moment of grace, and James Joyce called it an epiphany. And, you know, in the traditional Aristotelian pyramid of storytelling, we call it the character arc. But it's all the same thing. It's that moment when the character is redeemed by a new awareness of him or herself, or a new awareness of the world, and they grow because of that. And that's what I'm aiming for with every book. And they can't have that moment of growth unless they go through a lot of conflict and a lot of turmoil.
So when you're writing it, then do you because you're so close to what you're writing that it's hard to detach yourself and say, like, okay, that arc has been completed. Can you, you know, being alone with your work and not showing it to anyone, do you know that when you've achieved that? Can you tell?
Yeah, I can tell. And sometimes my characters will voice it to themselves. You may have noticed there's a lot of interior monologue in my novels.
Right.
And that's because most of my main characters tend to be pretty much like me, and that's a loner. You know, they tend to spend most of their time alone, and don't have too many friends or too many social interactions. So frequently, they have to admit to themselves, or they have to realize for themselves that things are different, that they're different. And sometimes it's just a small gesture that they make at the end. Because it can't be overdone, it can't be too strong, and just a small gesture at the end that signals their change, their moment of awareness. And the problem with a series is that each book, you know, the character has to make another change, another growth. But I personally think that is life. I mean, I think self-aware people are always changing and always growing and always trying to become better. If they're self-aware and they're well-intentioned people, they always want to improve, and they should always be reflecting. And I don't know, who was it who said the unexamined life is not worth living?
I don't know, but I've heard that before, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so my characters all engage in a lot of self-examination.
They do, yeah. There's no doubt about that when in reading this. And then there's so many heavy literary references that are amazing. And it's interesting to know that you didn't come from an MFA background and you know all the references that you have in there. And you mentioned that this is a series, so I was wondering, that was my next question to you, is that, you know, DeMarco, it says it's a DeMarco mystery, so this is one of an unknown number of books in a series featuring Ryan DeMarco?
Yeah, unknown at this point. Number two is coming out in January. It's called Walking the Bones, and we are currently in negotiations for book number three and four.
Okay, and is that with Source Books as well?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Fantastic. And for the listeners out there, we actually, Randall and I share the same editor with Sourcebook, so that's how we got connected. And so it's nice to have that small role element to this.
And she is a fantastic editor, by the way.
Yes. Yeah, so shout out to Anna Michaels.
This is absolutely great. And the publisher this year was named one of the top 10 publishers in the United States.
By production and volume put out, that I think they're the 10th largest publisher in the U.S., which is fantastic. And you know, I'm sure you feel as I do, very fortunate to be with such a good house.
I finally feel after, let me see, this was number 15, so I finally feel after 14 books that I found the home that I've been looking for as a writer. Ever since I started writing.
That's great. And tell me a little bit, and I don't want to keep you too much longer because first of all, you told me before we started this that, you know, it's you're in East Coast time, so it's a little bit late where you are, and you get up at about 3:30 in the morning every day. And so why do you do that?
Well, it all started back when my boys were young. Because I loved to play as big a role as I could in their lives. So I'd made them their breakfast. I'd get their clothes ready for them to go to school, and frequently I would take them to school. But before that happened, it's usually between 7 and 8 o'clock. I wanted to get some writing done, and frequently I was teaching back then as well. So I had other things to do during the day. So I would get up very early in the morning. Basically, I'd go to bed when my little boys went to bed, and I'd get up around 3:30 or 3 o'clock, and anywhere between 3 and 4, and get a couple of hours of writing in. And I did it for so long that it just became a habit to me. And now I automatically wake up every night somewhere between 3 and 4 o'clock.
And you just get up.
Yeah, I'll lie there for a while and think about what I'm going to do when I get up, or if I have a scene in mind, I'll kind of play it, run it over in my head, or I'll think about all the things I have to do that day. And then I get up, make a cup of tea. I do meditate for about 30 minutes in the morning, and then I get busy.
So meditation is a 7-day-a-week routine for you?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's tough when I miss it, when I'm out promoting the book or I'm in a hotel room or something, and anything that upsets my standard ritual in terms of where I am, where I sit, how I sit, and so forth, it makes the whole meditation process feel a little off balance and incomplete for me. But when I'm at home and I can do it exactly the same way every day, I can drag myself down those stairs and barely be able to stand erect and then get into the meditation. And by the time I finish meditating, I am charged up with energy and I'm ready to go.
Wow, that's fantastic. And do you do the same? And I'm interested because my girlfriend's a health coach and she has a meditation practice as well. Do you do the same meditation every day?
Yes. Yeah. It's basically a 3-stage, I think, meditation. I, As I said, I make a cup of tea, and then I'll go out on my back deck, and I love to stand on the deck when all I can see are stars overhead, and it's dark and everything at the entire neighborhood. I live in a tiny little development of 5 houses on a private cul-de-sac, so it's pretty quiet, and I love standing out there, and I just, you know, greet the day and thank the universe for another day, another chance to do something, and do that for a few minutes. Then I go inside, and on my mantle are pictures of my son, both of my sons, and my one son's wife and my other son's fiance, and my mom and my dad and my oldest brother, who have all passed away. And so, you know, I do a little ritual there with them, and then I go to my chair, and I basically have a little litany of gratitude that I do to the universe, and I just, thank the source for everything that I have and so forth. And the entire process takes about 30 to 40 minutes. And I end with some deep breathing and a little bit of chanting, just a little om work. And then I'm ready to roll.
Wow. That is truly inspiring. I that's a huge takeaway for hopefully all of us. But thank you for sharing that. That's a great.
Sure.
I can see why you would be kind of jolted if you're not able to have that same ritual every morning. And is it the same with writing for you? Do you need to be in the same kind of place all the time when you're writing, or are you a little bit more flexible with that?
I am more flexible. The difference is that I'm not self-conscious of the place or when I'm at my desk. Then it's just natural, and I can stop being aware of my body and the place and my comfort and so forth. But I've written in my car, I write in the park, because I always have a notebook with me wherever I go. But when I'm not at my desk and not sitting here alone in the house when it's nice and quiet, then I'm a little more self-conscious of the other external factors. So I'm not as fully immersed in my writing during those times.
Okay. And do you want to?
What's your practice?
Oh, so I'm. I get up early. I work out most days. That's kind of my meditation. I have a home gym, and then I write in the mornings. And that's usually all when I write. So just a little bit every morning, and but I just try to be very consistent about it. Because if I'm consistent about it, 7 days a week, which doesn't always happen, but if I'm consistent, then. In about a year, I can turn out a book with a couple edits done on it. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer, but I found that the whole key for me is just consistency. Always doing it. Like if you stop for a couple weeks, and I find that with all aspects of life and anything you do, as long as you're consistent, it just becomes part of who you are, and you'll see results. And people start saying, well, how do you write so much? I'm like, well, I don't write that much a day, but I do it every day, and stuff comes out. You'd be surprised if anybody can do it. If you just do a little bit every day, it'll get done.
Yep.
So that's the key for me, for sure.
I agree with you completely. Routine is important. In fact, one of the things I tell my students, especially the MFA students, is talent is not that rare. What's rare is talent and discipline, and you must be a disciplined writer, and it's the disciplined writers sometimes over the more talented writers who finally succeed in life as writers.
I would agree with that, and that's being willful is not always an easy thing to do, but that's definitely important. Can you let us all know what's coming out next? I know you have the second Ryan DeMarco coming out, and you have a couple of Poe books out, is that correct as well?
Yeah, the Source Books brought out, they re-released two of my, my only two Poe mysteries, On Night Shore and Disquiet Heart. Those had originally been published by St. Martin's a few years back, and Source Books was wonderful, and they surprised me by wanting to re-release them. So they came out in February.
Fantastic. Oh, William, you're very prolific. You have a lot of stuff out there, Randall. It's been a privilege to talk to you, and just for the audience, if you haven't read 2 Days Gone, I recommend that you run out and get it. It's 2 Days Gone by Randall Silvis. You've got a starred review from the Library Journal. It's a deep, dark book that's got a lot of hope and character arc in it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I've had so much fun talking to you tonight, and thank you for staying up a little bit late. Hopefully you'll get a little bit more sleep, and maybe you can sleep until 4 or 4:30 tomorrow.
Thank you, Carter. It was my pleasure. And by the way, let's remind the audience that Mr. Tender's Girl, your book, is coming out in February. Am I right? It is this February?
Yep, February from Source Books as well. So
I'm in the midst of reading it right now, and it's a difficult book to put down. I don't have a lot of time in a day to read, and your book is giving me problems because I want to keep reading and keep reading. From chapter to chapter to chapter, you just keep ratcheting up the tension and opening up new doors and new questions that make me want to find out what's going to happen. So you've done a fantastic job with that book, and I recommend it to everybody.
Oh, well, thank you for the kind words. That's great from somebody as established as you. So thank you very much, Randall.
My pleasure. Thanks. It's been great talking to
you. I want to take a moment to tell you both how much I, as your lowly tech for the evening, have enjoyed this conversation. I have a big grin on my face. Randall, first of all, to hear your gratitude to the universe is very heartwarming to me. I try to do that every day myself. And Carter, of course, you and I are pals. And if I know you, and I know you walk around with a big grin on your face all the time, you're always in a good mood. And I appreciate that about you both. But what a magnificent conversation from, I think, two of the best writers coming today. Thank you so much for being with me both. You know, Randall, we're going to let you go to sleep now. We've bothered you long enough. And Carter Wilson, congratulations again on your epic second in a row win with the Colorado Book Awards.
Thank you, Pam. Thanks, Randall.
Thank you both very much. It's been a pleasure.
Good night, all. Have a great evening. Thank you.
Night.
Good night.
All right, good night. And that's our show for tonight. Amazing. Thank you so much for being with me. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.